Morning, Mr. Chief Justice and other members of the court. I appreciate the court's giving me the opportunity to intervene in this matter. I think the issue that is now before this court does have repercussions and is going to involve, or affect, a number of people in years to come unless there is either legislative enactment or a decision that this court is favorable to the people that are, could be affected by this. Your Honor, as I believe that this decision, this case is controlled by your recent decision in Fletcher and Ellis. That case was decided on May 27th of this year, and while the state has filed a brief in response to my brief, I think I should state what we're not here arguing about. We're not arguing about the constitutionality of the SORA, I call it SORA, the Sexual Offense Registration Act. We're not here testing the Jacob Weathering Act, or we're not here dealing with the Adam Walsh Act, whether they're retroactive. One thing is perfectly clear, which the state concedes. None of these acts address the impact of a pardon on whether or not there should be registration. The state spends a great deal of time, I think, on matters that have nothing to do with the issue before this court. The issue before this court, I believe, is the interplay between the Section 4364 of Title 11 that provides for pardons and the SORA Act. And I think there is a great number of similarities between the two acts in question and what this court decided in the Fletcher case. Now, I want to go over those similarities because I think they control the outcome. Each of these cases concerns whether a convicted sex offender, and in the Ellis and Fletcher case, they're not convicted, they've been adjudged delinquent, is the only recourse to be relieved from the restrictions of the Registration Act, is it through the Sexual Registration Act, or is there an alternative? Both of these cases deal with that issue. The SORA Act does not address either issue. It does not address the impact of an expungement, nor does it address the impact of a pardon. Both cases deal with individuals who, as I sort of noted, have been adjudged delinquent or found guilty of sexual offenses. In the Fletcher and Ellis case, we're dealing with Bethany Ellis, who was a Tier 3 offender for her judgment of delinquency. And both Fletcher and Heath were dealing with people who have been required to register as Tier 2 offenders. I submit that both the pardon statute and the juvenile expungement statute grant relief to all offenders.
I'd like to ask you a question about the effect of the pardon statute.
Certainly.
Which, by its own terms, says, except as otherwise provided by the Delaware Constitution. It's, the General Assembly cannot, by statute, reduce the effect of a constitutional pardon, can it?
No, I do not believe they can reduce. I think what they attempted to do in 2003 was try to define the scope of what it meant. In the synopsis of the amendment to Section 4364, the General Assembly stated there is a great deal of ambiguity. And in an attempt to clear up that ambiguity, they sort of, I think, enacted a statute which is perhaps an expression of legislative intent, seemingly stating that unless there is a constitutional provision, an express statutory provision, or a court rule to the contrary, that the granting of a pardon, at least from the General Assembly's perspective, would restore somebody to all the rights they would have had prior to obtaining the pardon. So I don't think they can amend by statute the Constitution, but I think they've tried to define what
they tried to confirm what the Constitution, the effect of a pardon under the Constitution.
I think that's correct. I think it's been largely undefined, and you go back to the Weir case and the Skinner case, which I think is so readily distinguishable. In the Peterson case, which dates me a lot because I was there when that case was argued and helped participate in it, we were dealing with a Pennsylvania pardon of an individual who was convicted of a very serious sexual offense in the state of Pennsylvania. He sought to run for public office. This court held that a pardon forgives, but it didn't forget, but so focused on the specific statutory, or I'm sorry, specific constitutional language, which stated that those convicted of an infamous crime cannot run for public office. So I think it's pretty clear that you may very well have had a provision that the individual thought they could run, but there was a specific express constitutional provision saying, no, you cannot run. The same thing occurred in the Skinner case, as this court decided, in which an adult, in this case, sought to get an expungement. And I recognize the adult expungement statute differs from the juvenile expungement statute, But the adult expungement statute provides you only can get an expungement if you've been acquitted, received a nolle prosequi, or otherwise obtained a dismissal. So the fact that Mr. Skinner had received a pardon was not clearly stated as one of the bases. And I know that creates somewhat of an anomaly. You would think that you should be a pardon, should have that effect. But the court was very specific by saying it has to be specific. So in 2003, after the court, Delaware State General Assembly had enacted the sexual registration law in 1998, and which, by the way, I think has been amended somewhere between 10 and 15 times since that, this issue has never been addressed. But in 2003, the General Assembly took the statute and tried to give definition to what did it mean and stated this act will resolve much of the ambiguity and uncertainty surrounding the effect of a pardon by making it clear that the governor's decision to grant a pardon has the effect of restoring an individual's civil rights. I think what you see now is a situation where the juvenile expungement statute, which you dealt with in Fletcher, it's not totally complete and gives any juvenile. There's a carve-out. If you've been convicted or judged delinquent of murder second degree or arson first degree or burglary first degree, you do not get an expungement. If you do not get an expungement, you don't get the restoration of your civil rights, you are not going to be relieved from the sexual registration laws, if you had a sexual registration offense, even though those three offenses aren't necessarily related to sex offenses. And the pardon statute clearly states what just has been mentioned here, unless there is a specific expression. But in the pardon statute, there is such an expression. They've carved out one thing, 4764, which mirrors, I think it's the constitutional provision, if you have been convicted of certain enumerated crimes, like embezzlement, et cetera, you cannot receive a pardon. You cannot get a expungement of your record. And I think they've laid that out. So those convicted of certain numerous offenses cannot hold public office of trust, regardless of the fact that you received a pardon. Both the pardon and the expungement statutes have the same effect. They both intend to restore an individual to their full civil rights. I won't repeat the language of 4364, except to mention again, it was a fairly recent amendment. The Fletcher decision, which this court wrote and stated at page 196 of 974 Atlantic Second, states expungement means the eradication of a record of conviction or adjudication upon fulfillment of prescribed conditions. It lists disabilities and restores one to his or her civil rights. I think both of these statutes mean that you should get a restoration of your full rights. I would note, and I did note this on page 16 of my brief, at footnote 4, even the expungement statute, which is referenced as being an eradication of a juvenile record, isn't totally complete. Both under Section 1027 of Title 10 and the applicable provision in Title 11 does allow the superintendent of state police to maintain a record of even in situations where a juvenile's record has been expunged or an adult record has been expunged for purposes of employment if somebody were to apply for a police department and for criminal history information. So even in those situations where I think the court said it eradicates, I think it only eradicates for public consumption. It doesn't eradicate in all instances. There's still a limited use. In fact, it can probably keep you off a police force. So if you've got an expungement, you still would face that. As this court found in Fletcher and Ellis, there is absolutely no showing in the statute that the enactment of SORA was intended to repeal any part of the expungement statute. Similarly, I would suggest there's nothing in SORA showing any intent to effect an unconditional pardon. There have been no amendments changing that.
Mr. Oberle,
yes.
My question is, I understand that the pardon statute, in effect, mandates a restoration of civil rights. But does that mean that that once the executive, the unconditional executive pardon takes place, that that as a consequence it mandates undoing the registration under the Sex Offender Registration Act? That is, Would a lower court be mandated to do that on application, or would it simply give the lower court discretion to do that?
I think in the situation of pardon, it actually mandates that. If you look at the requirements of a pardon, and I think it's interesting, and it comes into the practical effect of the statute, not just the legal argument. The statute as set up for a pardon has specific requirements. And interestingly enough, to get a pardon, they've carved out instances where sex offenders. If you are a sex offender, to get a pardon, in addition to the Attorney General needing to give notification, and in deference to the fact that the Commissioner of Correction can do a full further investigation, the particular victim is notified, you must present a psychiatric or psychological report that actually states an opinion of some doctor or licensed psychologist, that it is that person's opinion that this person no longer is a threat to society. That's actually a stronger mandate than is required to get relief from the sexual offenders law, because under the sexual offender law, you can go down from tier 3 to tier 2, and sometimes you can get off completely by showing by a preponderance of the evidence that you are not a danger to the community. There's no requirement of a psychiatric report. It's just that you've certified that you've been through some sexual offender program mandated by the state. So I would submit that the requirements to obtain a pardon for a sex offender is essentially mirror, if not or more strict, than what's required to get a lower on the sexual registration law. And I think that's clearly an intent on part of the legislature to say, look, these cases are different, and we recognize that if we're going to give a pardon to somebody who has been a sexual offender, it's not like anything else. It's going to be a very, very strict test, and you're going to have to show a very clear indication that you are no longer a danger to the community, which is the exact same requirement in the sexual registration law get reduced to show you're not a danger to the community. If the relief sought in this application is not granted, you could have the anomaly which an individual could get a pardon, bring the evidence in, show there's absolutely no risk to society any longer, and then have to go through the exact same thing again in a discretionary ruling before the Superior Court judge, despite the fact that the Board of Parole has already ruled, the Board of Pardons has made a recommendation to the governor, and the governor has granted it pursuant to a statutory scheme. I guess that could be required, but it seems to me it would not make a great deal of sense to require somebody to go through that route. The state also makes, I think what the state has done in this case is essentially repackaged the very arguments this court rejected in the Fletcher Ellis case. They argue that, well, the statute doesn't say anything about it, therefore it must be permitted, seemingly ignoring the fact that Section 4364 says unless expressly taken out. They argue the converse and suggest that, seemingly, that this language should be ignored. I think it's interesting that in the brief filed by the state, it doesn't even address Fletcher. I'm sure the state will say, well, it did address Fletcher in the two pages it filed in response to the court's order prior to intervention. But we spent a great deal of time discussing the Fletcher decision in the brief, and in deference to Mr. Heath, who is obviously a non-lawyer and didn't file anything, I think, approaching a legal argument, I find the state's failure to address that somewhat peculiar. The state does address 4121Q of the sexual registration law, which says this section shall be effective notwithstanding any law, rule, or regulation to the contrary. This court already said in Fletcher that is easily reconcilable, and I don't necessarily need to read the quote, but I would suggest the quote that appears on 195, where this court said what that really means, is every bit applicable to the facts of this case. Turning to the practical aspects of this, which I've mentioned to some degree in response to the questions, one of the things the governor can also do by statute is place any restriction or condition he or she may wish to impose upon an offender. So even a sexual offender who comes before the governor that gets a pardon isn't guaranteed that that pardon may not have a condition that you still must register, which the governor could impose. So there's even
Is that statute necessary for the governor to impose a restriction?
No, I don't believe it would be. I think the governor has the inherent authority to put whatever conditions he or she may wish on a pardon. Although I have to admit I've not researched that particular constitutional issue, but my belief is the governor could do that. Again, I think it's an intent by the legislature to say, look, we can't resolve every and all unknown situations come before us. But, Governor, our belief is that you should be able to put any restriction on. And, again, it just may be reaffirming what may be the constitutional authority to govern in the first place. But I don't think that derogates from the fact that the governor can do it or would in any way minimize the argument of what should occur in this case.
Could the General Assembly require a restriction by the governor apart in any other way other than amending the Constitution?
In the light of what this court decided in Peterson and Skinner, it suggests to me that this court does find that there can be some limitations on the pardon, or at least an interpretation of how the pardon is to be interpreted. The one thing is fairly clear is there's been no decision for this court ever indicating that a governor's pardon gives some kind of carte blanche that totally free. I mean, the court said in Skinner, if you get a pardon, you are not going to necessarily get an expungement. That's a statutory provision. So in a roundabout way, I guess I would say that the legislature has the right to carve out the exceptions and at least express its opinion. And I guess if the governor didn't go that, it would end up before the court for interpretation. I'm not sure if I can answer that better. I would submit that one of the civil rights anybody would be entitled to is the right to privacy. The sexual registration law, which obviously has its place and is necessary in many cases, where somebody has gone through the honors requirements to obtain a pardon, in light of the fact that court, I mean, the board would know exactly what the pardon is for, to be restored to your rights, but to allow at the same time such an incredible invasion of your personal privacy, such as having people go to your neighborhood, posting your picture, I think clearly invades your privacy. And if the idea of a pardon is to restore your basic civil rights, one of those is that you should be able to be a right to be left alone. The state argues that a person is not relieved of registration requirement because obviously there is no statute specifically stating that. As I've stated, I believe that argument is totally contrary to what the pardon statute states. I think the state's attempt to say that Peterson and Skinner control this, I think, is certainly misplaced. And lastly, if there is any ambiguity in the statute, as this court stated in Fletcher, the rule of lenity would come into play, and it should at least be interpreted in the favor of the defendant or the appellant in this particular case. But I find nothing in anything I was able to research that would in any way suggest that an individual who's going through the pardon process should not be relieved of the registration requirement. And clearly, there's nothing in that law, the federal law, or any commentary that says otherwise. To argue that the states of Vermont and Florida and Arkansas and a couple other states have actually put it into their statutes somehow implicitly means that if it's left out of the statute, therefore the legislature expressly intended something, it is circular reasoning, which I think is unpersuasive. There's no reference as to what the case law is in those states. There's no references as to the particular statutes in those states. So to say that five states have dealt with it specifically and Delaware, it must mean impliedly you don't get that. I think is not in accord with what this court ruled in Fletcher, where you had language to the contrary. I have time left, but I have nothing further unless the court has questions.
I have a question for you, Mr. Oberle, and it's a little bit beyond the argument today, but it's one of implementation. If we were to agree with your position and we entered an opinion and the mandate goes to the trial court stating that your client or Mr. Heath is entitled to have his name removed from the registry, how does that functionally happen?
I think what functionally would happen is if the court makes the decision just as it did in Fletcher, something has to be done. I mean, the decision is going to have to be effectuated some way. You can say the expungement statute, as I understand it, exists and it was amended recently. You don't get an expungement just because somebody orders an expungement. You actually have to go to the police, I think in Dover or the one in Newcastle County, and you actually have to show that your case has been handled in such a way that you're entitled to have your record expunged. I think if this court stands on a ruling, and since whenever a pardon is granted, there's an official document that's produced. You would take that to the Delaware State Police, and they would then remove you from the expungement statute because you are entitled to be removed.
So it wouldn't take a remand to Superior Court and Superior Court issuing a writ of mandamus directed to the entity that keeps the registry. It would be simpler than that.
I think it would be very much simpler than that. At least my experience would be. I mean, I have never had the state police, in my experience of 30-some years, ignore a court ruling. It said this. I mean, is it theoretically possible somebody would say you have to go back to the court? It seemed to me to be a step that would be totally unnecessary. If you have been restored to your civil rights, you're restored to your civil rights, and one of those is to simply present the evidence. But I think there has to be an affirmative step by the person who's receiving the pardon to do something. It's not going to happen without that.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. The issue presented here, I guess, involves a couple of matters. One is, what is the effect of prior decisions of this court, particularly Skinner, and to, I guess, a lesser extent, the older decision in Peterson? And how is the sexual registration statute in Delaware to be interpreted when an individual such as Mr. Heath has received a pardon? Mr. Heath's case involves an adult defendant. He was 19 years of age at the time of this offense. So we're not concerned specifically with the juvenile expungement statute. This is a case where Mr. Heath, what he did was petition the Superior Court, where he had been adjudicated for the sex offense, to be removed from the Sexual Offender Registration Act. The Superior Court, in a bench ruling, turned that down. The state had objected to it and had pointed out this court's decisions in Skinner and Peterson that the fact that you have a pardon does not automatically relieve you of any and all other responsibilities. The registration of sex offenders in Delaware is a product of both a specific Delaware statute, a fairly involved series of statutes in 4120 through 4122 of Title 11, as well as two particular federal laws. The initial federal legislation, the Jacob Weatherling Act, didn't necessarily require the states to enact sexual offender registration laws, but the carrot was that if the states did not do so, they would lose 10% of their federal law enforcement block grants. As a consequence, all 50 states and the District of Columbia now have such registration statutes. The statutes, from the limited research I have done, don't all appear to be uniform. Some of them vary somewhat. There are provisions in the Jacob Weatherling Act, and it looks like most all the statutes that I looked at in Delaware in particular have picked up the tier classifications and those things. But there are other provisions in some state statutes that are not included in different state statutes. So exact comparison is not possible. But one thing I did note was that at least in five of the statutes that I looked at, those statutes, I think it's Vermont, North Carolina, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Florida, I believe, is the fifth one, have specific provisions that address this particular circumstance. That is, a person who has received a gubernatorial pardon, is that individual now relieved of the responsibility to register under that state's Sex Offender Registration Act? Those states do permit those people who have been pardoned to be relieved. Some of the states have distinctions between conditional and limited pardons or unconditional pardons, but if you have a full pardon, at least in those states, it's statutorily recognized that you do have a right not to, or you no longer have the obligation, rather, to continue to register as a sex offender, and the community notification requirements no longer apply in those circumstances.
Is a requirement to register as a sex offender a civil disability?
I would think it would be. I think it's like the collateral consequences we have with guilty pleas, that there are some civil disabilities that you may have. You may not be able to vote. You may have to register in certain jurisdictions if you're a convicted felon. So I think it's equivalent to that. It's a civil disability. You're not going to be put in prison unless you don't register. I mean, there is a criminal sanction for you if you don't register, but I think in the main it's a civil requirement that you do that. Its purpose is for protection and notification of the public, so I think viewed from that perspective as to its purpose, it is a civil type of remedy or requirement in this particular instance.
In those states that you mentioned where there's a statutory provision that says after, we'll assume, an unconditional pardon, that you're entitled to have your name removed from the register or you're relieved of the requirement of registering, do those states control the pardon process entirely by statute, or do they have a constitutional provision that sets some parameters for pardons and the consequences of being pardoned?
I'm not sure the answer.
And does it make any difference?
Well, it may. Normally, I think all states recognize what's an inherent executive power to pardon. It's usually specifically granted in a state constitution that the governor has, or chief executive has, the right to issue pardons, the same as the president does. And that's normally viewed as an absolute power, that the chief executive can pardon any individual he or she wishes to. Some states, like Delaware, have enacted some statutes that interpret that right, but I think it's just an inherent right of the executive of a jurisdiction. We have a difficulty with all of the provisions here because we're talking about some dual sovereignty issues as well, I guess, when you start getting into that. And the federal legislation, the Weatherling and the Walsh Acts, don't address the effect of state pardons. So I don't know what's going to become of that, if someone's going to challenge that or not, because it doesn't comply with federal legislation. I haven't found any decisions about that or even any discussions about those consequences. So I think if you focus on the state law that...
Well, Mr. Williams, you in response to Justice Ridgely's question, you seem to agree that a requirement to register is a civil disability of sorts?
I think that's true, yes, Your Honor.
And you cited Skinner as support for the state's position. Now, Skinner says, in part, that the effect, and I'm quoting, the effect of a pardon removes all legal punishments and disabilities attached to a conviction. Yeah. How do we deal with that language in the context of an unconditional pardon of a sex offender who, but for the pardon, would be required to register as a sex offender?
Well, I think you deal with it the same way this court dealt with Skinner, was talking about expungement of, I believe it was arrest records for an adult or something. The fact that you have a pardon may excuse that particular circumstance, but it does not erase all memory of it. The point of the sexual registration acts is to protect the public and to notify the public of individuals who fit in this category of individuals convicted of sex offenses. I think.
Can I interrupt you there?
Certainly.
I may be confused on this. I thought that you don't get a pardon unless it's been determined that you are not a threat to the public.
Well, I think That's certainly part of the pardon procedure. That's one of the requirements, so it's...
So doesn't that suggest that the purpose of the sex offender registration has been satisfied, if you will, that you know, if the public purpose behind it is to protect the public and to let everybody know that there's a potentially dangerous person in this location, and another procedure has established that this person is not a potentially dangerous person, then doesn't it seem consistent to then say that that determination, the pardon, also relieves you of your obligation to be registered as a sex offender?
Well, that would seem consistent, but I guess the difficulty is if you go back to Skinner was concerned with preserving arrest records for other purposes, and presumably that if you have the expungement, the conviction itself is wiped out, although the memory of it remains.
Okay, and maybe this is another area that I'm not all that clear on, but the pardon is not an expungement, right?
That's correct. Okay. Those are separate procedures.
Okay. So person A commits a sex offense, gets a pardon. Arguably, as a result of that pardon, does not have to register anymore. But the conviction is still of record in, I don't know, the prothonotary's office or in the court records for the state of Delaware, and therefore there's been no expungement. It hasn't been erased. It has simply been, you know, resolved, if you will. So expungement is not the same as a pardon. And even if you were taken off of the sex registry, you still would have a record of your offense in court records, wouldn't you?
Well, I think you probably would, at least for adults. And that's what Skinner was talking about. It wasn't a sex offender, but it was...
So this wouldn't be inconsistent with Skinner, is what I'm saying, would it?
No, I think the difficulty here is reconciling how Skinner impacts all of this. And I think what Skinner says is that simply getting a pardon does not mean that any and all record is forever erased. I mean, I think that's the holding, at least, of Skinner. And it is applicable to an adult defendant such as Mr. Heath. The question then becomes, well, what does that impact now mean as to the sexual notification requirements and the sexual registration requirements?
And Skinner says that the effect of the pardon is to remove all disabilities.
Yes, it says that, but it certainly doesn't get rid of the arrest records, and I would argue that, you know, that's certainly a disability of some sorts if you're applying for a job and someone can access that. If you want to be a police officer or a law enforcement officer, that's going to be a disability. I don't know that it means exactly what it says, because I think there's still a disability hanging out there.
If that sentence doesn't mean exactly what it says, then the sentence of pardon forgives the conviction but does not obliterate it from the public's memory doesn't necessarily mean what it says. Why does Skinner mean anything at all?
Well, I don't know. I've been having trouble deciding what Skinner does mean in the context of the sex registration provisions, because that was not what this court had to address in Skinner, and of course there wasn't any reason to.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Mr. Heath, having obtained an unconditional pardon, would at least have standing, would he not, to seek either an expungement of his conviction or, apart from that, to have his name removed from the registration list. Is that correct?
I think he would have standing, certainly, to petition for either one. What he did was just ask to be removed from the sexual register. He didn't ask for an expungement.
Right.
But I don't see any reason why he wouldn't have standing to do both.
Well, and he wouldn't have a prayer of getting the expungement, though, would he?
Not under Skinner.
No, because he has a conviction for which he was pardoned. It wasn't a nulla prosequi. It wasn't an acquittal.
Right.
It wasn't otherwise dismissed, whatever that means.
So well,
why would he bother to seek an expungement when he's got no chance of getting one?
Well, probably not after the Skinner interpretation of the statute. And I think the adult expungement statute is very straightforward. There are very limited categories. The difficulty I've had with trying to reconcile all of this is that other states have included in their sex registration requirements a specific exception for individuals who are pardoned. They are relieved from the responsibility. The Delaware legislature simply hasn't acted one way or the other on that. The question that occurred to me was, well, if it was so obvious that a gubernatorial pardon by the state's chief executive eliminates everything, then why would states feel it incumbent upon, at least some states feel it incumbent upon themselves or their legislatures anyway, to include in their statutes provisions that say if you're pardoned, then you no longer have to register as a sex offender?
We agree that this was an unconditional pardon, correct?
Absolutely. I don't see any conditions.
Was the recommendation of the Board of Pardons, is that known to us, what they recommended to the governor?
I think they would have recommended a pardon because my understanding, I haven't been before the pardon board for a while, is that you don't get to the second step of going to the governor unless the board recommends that your pardon be granted.
Well, let me be less coy about it. Evidently, the Board of Pardons, which has a Deputy Attorney General representing it and has the Chancellor on the board, so at least two lawyers, if not more, did not recommend a condition of continuing to be registered on this pardon, nor did the governor, who presumably had the advice of governor's counsel, didn't attach a condition that Mr. Heath continued to be on the registry. Why should we, recognizing that, craft any result other than it's an unconditional pardon, it's a disability to remain on the registry? Therefore, he has a right to have his name removed from the registry.
Well, I think the reason is that neither the pardon board nor the governor or governor's counsel in the letter that she drafted to Mr. Heath advising him of the result mentioned anything about the sexual registration requirement. I'm not sure that it was ever considered. There's no evidence that it was or wasn't considered. It's just not addressed at all. So I think.
But it was clear that it was a sex crime that he was being pardoned for, correct?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I think that it said what the original offense was and what it had been pled down to, the lesser included offense. So I think certainly all that was before the pardon board and the governor and the governor's legal counsel. So I think that was obvious, but there's nothing that I can see in the limited paper record that indicates anyone was addressing or confronting what the potential impact would be of a pardon upon the sex registration requirements of the Delaware law this case.
It would seem to me logical that anyone applying for a pardon in trying to suggest to the Board of Pardons for the purpose of their recommendation that the pardon is a burden that outweighs the impact of the original conviction, wouldn't make the point that one of the onerous aspects of continuing to carry this conviction is the fact that my opportunities in this world are limited by the fact wherever I go, I have to register as a sex offender. Does the record suggest that was never even argued or considered? It's also difficult for me to understand why a Deputy Attorney General whose duty it is to protect the public, wouldn't be saying to the Board of Pardons, now, one of the conditions that you should put on this pardon, in order to protect the public and to preserve the memory of the conviction, is a stipulation that he continue to register as a sex offender, even though he's pardoned for this offense. And apparently, there's no record either way of that.
Well, I think that's true. What the record indicates, the application was that Mr. Heath wanted a pardon because he wanted to be a truck driver, And then apparently to get that training or to be licensed and bonded, I guess, as a truck driver, he needed to have this pardon. He also mentioned that he was a single parent and had a four-year-old child, and it was important to be able to support her, and that he hoped that by gaining the pardon that he would be able to pursue this career as a truck driver. So I think, and I'm assuming here, that there may be bonding requirements for long-haul truck drivers or something like that. Usually when people come into the pardon board, when they're seeking a pardon, they mention that there's a job opportunity. There were several applications when I was doing the Board of Pardons from individuals who were seeking employment with MBNA and similar employers. And the thing they always mentioned was that in order to be hired, the personnel office had told them that while they may have had a juvenile shoplifting offense or even an adult minor theft offense, that they could still be hired if they received a pardon. And I'm assuming that the reason for that was bonding requirements, people handling money or having access.
And the other side of the coin is we have no evidence that the Attorney General's office raised the issue of conditioning the pardon on continued registration.
No, I don't think they even did. There's no indication of it. They apparently, there were different deputies handling these proceedings. The deputy that appeared at the pardon board indicated no opposition, and I'm assuming the reason for that is because Mr. Heath had done what he was supposed to. He completed the 2 years of probation. He was actually discharged from that with no further requirements. His goal was to become a truck driver's express goal.
If the Board of Pardons makes a recommendation simply for a pardon, an unconditional pardon, does the governor, and it goes to the next step to the governor, does the governor have the authority under the Constitution to reject that recommendation and grant a conditional pardon?
I would think the governor could.
Because the governor can say, no, I'm not
going to
grant it.
The governor can certainly turn down the recommendation of the board, because it is a recommendation, but the governor has the final say-so one way or the other. And I think if the governor has the final say-so, that part of that authority would be to place conditions on it that the governor could do
the
that.
The governor does not need a statute to authorize that ability under the Constitution.
I wouldn't think so. I don't think the statute, I think the statute in this case is more attempting to clarify what some of these questions are, although I guess the reason we're here today is that we haven't clarified all of the questions. But the problem is the interplay between the governor's power to pardon people and the state statute. Ultimately, if the legislature wants people who receive pardons to be relieved of the sex offender registration requirements, they can easily do that by simply passing an amendment similar to the other states I've cited in the brief and say, there's no question, if you've got the pardon, you don't have to register anymore. That would simplify it. But in the absence of that, I think that the difficulty as posed by these decisions in Skinner and Peterson is that doesn't necessarily mean you're relieved of that.
Can they do the opposite? By statute, say that notwithstanding an unconditional pardon, a person who was previously convicted as a sex offender must continue to register.
I'm not sure about that, because I think the problem with that is that you have separation of powers questions. You're talking about the executive's authority and the legislature's authority. And my understanding of the pardon power, excuse me, as I think I said, is that it's supposed to be an absolute power that the governor has. So I don't think the legislature could necessarily do the converse. But I think they could recognize, if they were so inclined, that if you get the governor's pardon, then fine, we're going to relieve you of the registration requirements. So I'm pretty sure about that. As the converse, I think there's a problem with separation of powers.
And to further unnecessarily complicate this web, if the governor conditioned the pardon on continuing to be registered, and there was a statute that said if the governor pardons you, you no longer have to be registered, I take it that the governor's power under the Constitution would prevail, and that person would have to be registered.
I'm not sure about the answer to that. I don't
know. Never
mind. That's a real quandary.
First, we have a Delaware constitutional scholar on this court, and we'll find out from him later.
I don't know. That's the collision of the iceberg and the Titanic, and I'm not sure which one wins that. I'm down to my last minute. If there's any additional questions, I'll certainly try to answer those.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sometimes it's maybe best to waive your argument. I do want to make a point. I think there's a difference between a civil right and what may be considered a civil disability. The legislative intent was that people be restored to their civil rights, and I think Mr. Williams has conceded that. This is a civil right, and it should be restored. The fact that an adult, even via a pardon, may not necessarily have an erasure or an expungement of the arrest record, I don't think equates the same as with being a civil right. It may result in some disability, and I think as years have gone by, and arrest records become more of a severe disability and perhaps should be addressed by the legislature. But I see there's a separation in that regard. Also, I just would like to clarify as to the pardon requirements. I appear before the Board of Pardons frequently. The person makes an application. The application then is sent out to all various police departments and the Attorney General's office. A hearing is scheduled, and this, in a case like this, when an individual's out, he also had to present, I believe, some evidence that he wasn't a danger to the community because it was a sexual offense. And a hearing is scheduled before the Board of Pardons, and the Board of Pardons, the Attorney General's office, does appear in all cases, and they make a recommendation. They can make whatever recommendation they please at the particular time. In this case, there was no objection to the pardon, and I think the result of probably had to do with the facts of the case. As I understand the facts of this case, it was a 19-year-old young man, and it was a 14-year-old young woman. It was more of a consensual thing, although our law does not allow that. It wasn't a vicious, violent attack in that regard. And a number of years had passed from 2000 up to 2008. He was now 28 years old, and the state felt that there was no objection, as I understand the facts. But the Board of Pardons then actually convenes in that day and votes. And the majority controls, whether it's five members, and if three members vote, it goes to the governor with a recommendation. I have seen them go to the governor's office with recommendations as to such things as continued drug therapy, that the pardon become effective at a certain period of time, and then it's up to the governor to do what he or she wants. And I've seen a number of them denied by the governor, even though they've been recommended by the board. But in response to Justice Richard's question, I believe the governor can condition and put any restrictions on that he or she wants, and I think that would probably trump, certainly it was trump the board because the board can't overrule the governor. I'm not aware of whether it would trump a statute, but I think it would raise an interesting question, as Mr. Williams raised. If they were in direct conflict and the statute said one thing and the governor's pardon said another, but if the governor's pardon power is unconditional, I suspect that may trump that, but I don't think that's the issue we have here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.